This is the final section of what is otherwise a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner, entitled The Child's Changing Consciousness and Waldorf Education. This last section is introductory words spoken before a Eurythmy performance, Dornach, April 15, 1923. Once again, we would like to try to give you an impression of Eurythmy. It is an artistic movement that draws upon hitherto unaccustomed sources and that makes use of an unfamiliar language of forms. Therefore, it may be permissible for me to say a few words beforehand. I do not intend to explain the performance. This would be inartistic. Every art must speak for itself. And especially in the case of an art form that was created to be seen, one should not attempt to give detailed explanations. It should simply be watched. You will see human figures performing gesture-like movements on the stage, mainly with their arms and hands, the most expressive of our limbs, but also with other members of the human organism. You will see individual figures as well as groups of eurythmists, the latter spread out in certain spatial relationships, and performing various forms and patterns as they move about. However, none of all these movements and gestures should be looked upon as arbitrary or fortuitous, for they are intended to convey a definite visible language or visible music. This is the reason why Eurythmy is accompanied either by recitation and declamation, as in the case of poetry, or by various kinds of music. During the course of life, a human being progresses from the first babbling sounds of babyhood, which express only feelings and sensations in primitive form, to the articulated speech of later stages. In a similar way, it is also possible to progress from the primitive and natural gestures, babbling gestures, I should like to call them, made in ordinary life, to lend clarity, emphasis, or feelings to the spoken word, to a visible form of speech, brought about by the movements of the entire human organism. And so, what you are about to see on the stage does not rest upon artificially contrived movements, but is based upon an exact and careful study according to Goethe's method of what he called sensible supersensible beholding of how the spoken word and human song come into being. For in this case, too, one has to do with a kind of gesturing. This form of gesturing, however, does not take place within the ordinary visible human organism, but within the outflowing breath. Naturally, the breath is always directed, partly by human will forces, aided by the relevant physical organs, and partly by human thinking. We know that in speaking, air is set into motion. If we studied in detail the forms of these air movements, by means of which human beings communicate with one another, we should find that a definite flow form of the outstreaming air corresponds to each sound, to each word figuration, and to the configuration of each sentence. Air forms, flowing out more radially from a speaking person, issue from the region of the human will, of course always through the agency of physical organs, as already mentioned. Sounds that shape these air gestures into waves of a more cross-sectional type, if I may use such a term, stem from human thinking. If we could see these gestures of moving air as we can see the human being in motion, and this is possible through sensible, supersensible beholding, we should have before us a kind of aeriform image of the human being, or at least of part of the human being. And within this image we would see movement, movement of flowing air. It is these air movements which are being studied carefully, but instead of letting the larynx and the other speech organs transform the air gestures into speech or song, they are turned into gestures performed by the arms, by the hands, or by the entire human figure, also by groups of eurythmists moving in definite patterns. Through this arrangement, what is happening in ordinary speech or song has now been made visible, the only difference being that the thought element has been left out of these movements. The thought element always tends to be inartistic and prosaic. In order to express themselves artistically through the medium of language, poets have to struggle against the thought element. They have to wrest away from the thought sphere what language offers to them. In a certain way, they try to loosen the thoughts from language, retaining only its will element, which they use in order to express their soul experiences. This is the reason why we do not express the more undulating forms of air gestures, which emanate from the thought content, but, preferably, those which are streaming outward radially in a sound, in a word, or in the formation of a sentence. In making the appropriate eurythmy movements that accompany the spoken word, a unique opportunity is given for bringing to outer expression, clearly and visibly, what the poets have been experiencing within their souls. To believe that human souls and spirits are linked to any particular part of the physical body surely amounts to some kind of prejudice, for in reality the human soul completely permeates the entire organism right into the outermost parts of the periphery. It lives in all that is outwardly expressed, in every physical manifestation. Poets experience the content of a poem with their entire being, but strictly speaking, they have to hold back what wants to flow into their limbs. Admittedly, there are only a few poets who really go through this experience. I think that one could safely say that of all that is being produced in the art of poetry, some 99% could well be left out of account without incurring too great a loss in the artistic field. But any deeply experienced poetry is experienced by the totality of the human being, and then soul and spirit are pouring into the entire being of the individual concerned. What a poet tries to achieve through the imaginative, the formative pictorial qualities of sound formation, or through the element of rhythm and beat, and also through the musical and thematic treatment of sound production, all this is basically achieved by letting the prose content of the words recede, while giving voice to what is truly poetical and artistic. Consequently, if the art of recitation is to do justice to a poet's work, it must not lay the main emphasis upon the prose meaning, something that has become all too popular in our inartistic age, but it should concentrate on the way in which the spoken word is formed. This has been striven for in the art of recitation, which is being cultivated here, and to which Frau Dr. Steiner has devoted herself for some considerable time. If the meaning of the spoken word is stressed in recitation, the result will be prose in essence. Though this may appear interesting and intriguing, because, so one believes, the personality of the reciter will then be in the limelight, it nevertheless remains inartistic. The artistic approach lies in the speaker's ability to bring out various qualities, such as passionate feelings, emotions, and in the case of thoughts, the communication of the thoughts themselves, by means of the pictorial element and the plasticity of the sounds as they follow one another, and also through the way in which diverse sound nuances mutually affect each other. It cannot be achieved by concentrating on content alone. If a thought is to be expressed poetically, the form of the thought has to be toned down. The poetic quality of language has to be looked for solely in the way speech is formed. Apart from the image-creating quality and the plasticity of speech, the essence of recitation is found equally in its musical, beat-directed, and rhythmical aspects. In prose, verses are obviously out of place, but in poetry there is every need for them, for they offer a kind of meeting ground, which, with its rhythmical and musical qualities, is of fundamental importance in speech. And so in the work of a genuine poet, we already find a hidden eurythmy in the way in which language is treated. Hence there is nothing artificial, in fact only something entirely natural, in eurythmy bringing to outer manifestation what the true poet has suppressed, at least to a certain extent. Poets want to place into the world, with their entire being, what they bring down into earthly incarnation. But being restricted to the medium and use of language, they must artificially restrain certain aspects of what they desire to express with the fullness of their humanity. All this is again released on being transmuted into a visual expression through the agency of eurythmy. Hearing the speaker's recitation, while, at the same time, seeing the soul and spiritual counterpart, which ordinarily flows into the spoken word, in the movements of the performing eurythmists, one receives a direct picture of the full poetic experience. To make this inherent poetic experience visible through movement, quote, painted into space, unquote, this is what Eurythmy really wants to achieve. If you wish to let Eurythmy work upon the soul in the right way, you must not confuse it with the neighboring arts of mime and dancing. Eurythmy is neither the one nor the other. However, nothing derogatory must be read into my words, for the importance of these two arts is not meant to be minimized or contested in any way. Nevertheless, Eurythmy, has its own and distinctly different aspirations, and if some of its gestures should appear to be close to mime, it can only be the result of what I would like to call a mood of mockery or scorn inherent in the poetry, or of an attempt to rise above a given situation. One might compare it with someone making a wry mouth or winking an eye while speaking. Any quasi-mimic Eurythmy gestures need to be regarded in this light, and if Eurythmists choose to make them, they are justified in doing so. However, I am not referring to the actual art of mime, but only to the odd occasion when Eurythmy may slide into a style akin to mime, which, strictly speaking, is unwarranted, because Eurythmy then loses its chastity. Likewise, what I am going to say does not refer to dancing as an art in its own right, but only to an illicit alienation of Eurythmy into dancing. Certainly it is possible for Eurythmy movements to pass over into dance-like movements. For instance, if a poem speaks of a person hitting another, or of setting upon another, or displaying passionate conduct. In such an instance, Eurythmy movements, which are usually entirely contained within the realm of the physical body, can turn into dance-like movements. However, if Eurythmy unjustifiably degenerates into dancing, if dancing invades the realm of Eurythmy for its own sake, it has a brutalizing effect. Again, I am not saying that the art of dancing is brutal, but that if Eurythmy slides into a form of dancing, it is being brutalized. A genuine appreciation of Eurythmy surely entitles one to state quite clearly, Eurythmy is neither a form of mime, which is communicated by means of suggestive movements, nor is it a form of dance, in which extravagant and passionate movements are made, no longer contained within the dancer's sphere of consciousness. Eurythmy occupies an intermediate position. It neither indulges in ardent or exuberant dance movements, nor does it use pantomimic gestures, which always lean toward the intellectual side. In Eurythmy, expressive and meaningful gestures are performed, which in their own way are meant to have an aesthetic and artistic effect. These gestures are neither intellectually thought out, nor are they excessive by nature. They are neither to be explained away, nor should they be overpowering to the Eurythmist or the onlooker. Through the immediacy of its line, and through the entire mode of movement, Eurythmy should appear both pleasing and beautiful in the eye of the beholder. Seeing a song or music expressed in movement will always convey a right impression of what Eurythmy is. Presently, you will hear pieces of music performed in Eurythmy. This music, Eurythmy, is not dancing either. If it is done properly, it differs essentially from any kind of dancing. It is singing, not with voices, but with physical movements. It is just this singing, transmuted into visible movement, which enables one to differentiate Eurythmy from its neighboring arts. Seeing it on the stage will help you to gain a true conception of what I have been talking about. Eurythmy is only at the beginning of its development, and it will need a long time to reach some stage of perfection. This is why, before each performance, I have to ask the audience to be tolerant. During its earlier stages, only one side of Eurythmy was developed. But, for example, we have added stage lighting to enhance the visual effects of the performing Eurythmists. These changing colored lights on the stage are to work as a kind of light Eurythmy, which is to serve and to accompany the movements of the Eurythmists, so that really the entire stage picture becomes one Eurythmic expression. However, there is no doubt that stage presentation of Eurythmy will be improved in many ways during the coming years. One may have faith in this future perfecting, because eurythmy makes use of the most perfect instrument available for any artistic expression. It is the human being who is a microcosm, a whole world in a small space, containing all the secrets and inherent laws of the universe. For this reason, if all the potentialities offered by the human organism were fully realized, fundamentally speaking, the moving eurythmist would present a true and artistic image of all cosmic secrets and laws. The art of mime uses only one side of the human being, and so do the other arts, which each in its own way also treat the human individual, as an instrument. One could say eurythmy does not depend on an external instrument, nor on any one part of the human being, but transforms the human entity, and especially the most expressive members, namely the arms and hands, into visible speech and visible song or music. One may hope that when the possibilities inherent in eurythmy have been fully developed, a time will come when this youngest of arts will find its place side by side with the older arts in its own right. That's the end of that last section. This all comes from the book The Child's Changing Consciousness and Waldorf Education. I believe the newer title is The Child's Changing Consciousness as a Basis for Waldorf Pedagogy, or for Pedagogical Practice, something like that. These lectures were given, from April 15th through April 22nd.